This talk was recorded by Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. For more talks and information, visit www.imsb.org.
So tonight's talk, the topic that Cheryl asked me to talk about, is not to tell falsehoods or do not tell lies. I don't know if I can go a whole half hour, three quarters hour on this topic, so I've opened it up to write speech. So the outline of my talk, the first part is the importance of the precepts, then right speech, and to not speak falsehoods, then preserving the truth, which you'll find interesting, and other aspects of right speech, harsh speech, divisive speech, and idle chatter. Now the importance of the precepts, so the Buddhist path is divided into called Sili, Samadhi, and Panya, or ethical conduct, concentration of wisdom, or instead of concentration is development. And so for the Eightfold Path, ethics is considered right speech, right action, and right livelihood, and right concentration or development is right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, and wisdom is right view and right intention. So Lee Brazington, this is a friend of mine who's wrote an article in Buddha Dharma, and he says basically the Sila, Samadhi, and Panya comes down to clean up your act, concentrate your mind, and use the consecrated mind to investigate reality. Now, some people have the idea is all you need is meditation and that'll develop your ethics. And it does say in the suttas that meditation will help enhance your virtue, but also says virtue will enhance your meditation, and they're very strong about that. I'm a very strong believer that the Buddha did lay out an Eightfold Path, and virtue is part of it, and we should be putting at least as much effort into that as we do our meditation. And looking at a practical point of view, I mean, would you want to have friends who break the precepts? Would you have friends who cheat on their partners and lie and... Gil Fransdale tells a story of a woman from Taiwan, a very devout Buddhist, and he asked her, how come you don't meditate? And she goes, I haven't perfected my virtue yet. Ajahn Jeff says, virtue develops noble character. And here's a quote from Upandita. I don't know if you know, this is in Inquiring Mind about Sila. Upandita is... one of the most senior students of Mahasi Sayadaw, who started the meditation teachings that's used at IMS and at Spirit Rock. So he says here, Sila means taming our physical and verbal behavior. As human beings, we are social animals living with others on this planet. Obviously, most sentient beings don't want to be harmed. Each human being must control his or her own actions. No one else can do that for us. We each should contemplate our actions as followed. If that were done to me, I'd find it unbearable. The other person will feel the same way, so I won't do it. We may need the courage to restrain ourselves if the impulse toward harm is strong. Here's the part I love. He goes, quite frankly, people who lack basic morality are disgusting. No matter how expensive their jewelry or clothing may be, they're unattractive and offensive. It's as if they smell bad. In contrast, Sila is like the fragrance of an ornament. We have a saying, Sila makes the wearer beautiful. And he goes on to say, during the Buddha's lifetime, a divine being, a deva, asked him a question in the form of a riddle. What is it that's good up to old age? And the Buddha replied, Sila. Indeed, Sila is good from when we were born until the very moment we die. It is one of the most important tasks a human being can undertake. Sila is not only needed by Buddhists, it is needed by the whole world. Sila Punya makes a person a true human being. So, right speech. Right speech is one of the factors, as I said, of the Eightfold Path. And it consists of not lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle speech. Now, the lying part, we know the precepts. Not lying is one of the precepts. The way the Eightfold Path is broken out is under right speech, you have not lying, and the four other precepts is under right action. So the precept is not to tell lies, and one takes the precept by saying, I undertake the training rule to not tell lies. And what they're talking about is not intentionally telling lies. And everybody knows why, pretty much why you shouldn't lie. I mean, a person who lies, you can't trust them. And also, if you tell lies, you have to keep track of them. Now, I would imagine most of you don't tell lies. Would you all agree to that? Well, there's this book I read a while ago. It's called The Liar in Your Life, The Way to Truthful Relationships, written by a psychologist. And here he says people lie all the time. And a lot of what he's talking about is white lies. Now you may go, well, yeah, white lies aren't bad. But before I give you the science about white lies, we're going to go to a higher source. It's not Dear Abby. Dear Abby's not a liar, so it's Dear Amy. Replace Dear Abby. It says, I have been dating my girlfriend for 9 years. She's a very loving, caring, and fun person to be with. All my friends and family think she's great, and so do I, except for one little thing. She lies. They're not big lies, but silly ones she calls little white lies. I have talked to her about it, and she feels justified doing so to prevent hurting other people. That's because she has a hard time saying no. If someone were to call her and ask a favor, the only way she can say no is to make up some sort of story about why she can't do it. She knows I don't like it. While she might be getting better about it, I still have a hard time with it. If little lies come so easily to her, what about big lies? What do you think about this? And Amy writes, I agree that this habit could create basic trust issues between you. For instance, if she told you she couldn't call because her phone ran out of juice, could you believe her? So even white lies has a tone in there. And what he says about in here about white lies, he says, this is what I call the myth of the little white lie. According to this myth, little white lies are not the same thing as real lies. Little white lies, like a lie of social convenience or the my pleasure we hear receiving our dry cleaning, are so negligible, or so the myth says, that they shouldn't even be grouped with lies like those of the seven dwarfs. Real lies are bad. They cost money and cause pain. Real lies are morally wrong. Little white lies, by somewhat circular definition, don't hurt anywhere. Unfortunately, the myth of the little white lie is basically a fairy tale. Although little white lies may be less egregious than real lies, they still, like all deception, involve some degree of victimization. If a lie succeeds, someone is always fooled. And crucially, even if the target of the lie doesn't know this lie, the liar does. And he goes on to say there's a researcher at Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, who says that, you know, white lying takes a toll on the teller of the lie. Lying can cause a twinge of distress in DiPaolo's words, making liars feel a little worse than they did before they told the lie. Further, this coloring of the mood can last even after the conversation has returned to more honest territory. The sum effect of this is what DiPaolo calls an emotional smudge on the interaction. Conversation involving lies are less warm, less intimate, less comfortable than those that are more honest. And like I said, many people feel that white lies aren't a big deal, but how would you feel if you found out, like someone complimented you and you found out they were only doing that not to hurt your feelings? You would have a different opinion of them. Another way we can be less than truthful is we can exaggerate a lot of our stories. And if you really watch your mind, you'll see how it does that. Another thing is, and this was a real eye-opener for me, I took, I can't think of Kramer's first name, he teaches the Inside Dialogue. And I took his first course he took here years ago in the Bay Area. And when I was working with another person, I realized we had to repeat what the person said. But really watching my mind, I realized if the mind didn't remember something, it'll make it up. And there are a lot of studies about that with memory. And so you got to be really careful what you say. I mean, you're, in a way, it's not intentional, but in some ways it is intentional. You're not really paying attention. So one of the general rules the Buddha gives for speaking is that what you speak is truthful, useful, and timely. Now, what this means is about the useful and timely is if you see somebody and, you know, their hair doesn't look nice or something, you don't have to say it. Just because you think, you know, the expression, just because it comes up in your meditation, you don't have to follow it. It's the same thing with your speech. Just because something comes in your mind doesn't mean you have to say it. Now, the last topic in lying is Ajahn Jeff's feeling, I know, on the precepts, is they're almost like absolutes. And it's a good attitude to have, because if you start thinking of excuses why you can break the precepts, one little, it can snowball. But people also bring up a lot of these ethical dilemmas when it comes to speeches. And he was giving a Sati Center event, and he cut people off the pass, and he said to people, how many of you know of people who are hiding Jews in their basements? Because that's a classic one. During World War II, there are people who held Jews in their basements. And if the Nazis came to your house, what would you say? One of the interesting things, if you're really honest, it may be difficult to lie because they can see it in your face, but also what's to say that they'll even believe you? But the important thing here is, like I said, I think a lot of people trivialize these precepts. It does require a lot of skill and navigation, and so you got to be creative. Like, I don't know what the person talked about not killing, but the question was comes about ants. And you have to be really skillful. You have to be proactive to keep your ants out if you really want to obey the precept. Every year I sit a self-retreat at Vajrapani, which up in the Santa Cruz Mountains. One of these you really got to pay attention to is all the bugs up there, and also especially how to keep them out. So it takes a lot of forethought and planning. The next topic I'd like to talk about is called preserving the truth, and you'll see how this fits in. This is in Middle Length Discourses, Majjhimanikaya 95. And basically a Brahmin asked the Buddha this. Master Gotama, in regard to ancient Brahmic hymns that have come down through oral transmission in the scriptural collections, the Brahmins come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. What does Master Gotama say about this? And he goes through and he says, you know, the people who say this, I mean, they don't know this is true. The people who told him don't know, and he goes back four generations. And so he questions whether that's really true. And then the Brahmin says, well, it's an oral tradition. And the Buddha says to him, says, there are five things, Bharadvaja, that may turn out two different ways here and now. What five? Faith, approval, oral tradition, reasoned cognition, and reflective acceptance of view. These five things may turn out two different ways here and now. Now, something may be fully accepted out of faith, yet it may be empty and hollow and false. But something else may not be fully accepted out of faith, and yet it may be factual, true, and unmistaken again. And then he goes through the other things. And then Gotama asks him, but Master, Master Gotama, in what way is there the preservation of truth? How does one preserve the truth? And the Buddha says, if a person has faith, Bharadvaja, he preserves the truth when he says, my faith is thus. But he does not yet come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, everything else is wrong. In this way, Bharadvaja, there is the preservation of truth. In this way, he preserves the truth. In this way, he describes the preservation of truth. But as yet, there is no discovery of the truth. I mean, how many times do a lot of us go, this is true, or rebirth is true, or Buddhism is true, or rebirth is not true? And people hold it as truth when it's really a belief, and they come off as telling the truth. And that's something we can also watch in our speech also. It's my opinion that a lot of the world's problems is do people take their beliefs to be the truth, and then they cause a lot of problems in the world. So I'm going to do an exercise here that Sylvia Boorstein once did at Insight Meditation Center, which I found really fascinating. How many of you have had a physical injury in the last year that's still affecting you? Raise your hands. How about in the last 3 years, which you had like 3 or 5 years ago that's still affecting you? Anybody? How about 10 years? Wow, this is interesting. 15? Wow. 20? It's turning out differently than I expected. All right, now how many have been affected by, in the last year, of someone speaking to you harshly? Still affected by it. How about the last 5 years? 10 years? 15 years? 20? Okay, now, what's interesting is this is around the same as the injury. When Sylvia did this at IMC, it turned out people were much more affected in the past from the speech than the injury. So it shows you words are very, very powerful. They're like weapons. So we need to choose them really carefully. So the first is harsh speech, and the Buddha defined it as speech that destroys the friendship between two people. And Buddha Gautama says, if your goal is to manipulate others or to earn someone's gratitude or appreciation, your speech is self-serving and malicious rather than virtuous. Goes on to say, verbal abuse, profanity, sarcasm, hypocrisy, and excessively blunt or belittling criticism. And so it's very important to use our words carefully when we speak to people. Now, some people come back with harsh speech because they've been given harsh speech. People have come at them with anger or something like that. And how to deal with that is a whole nother talk, but I really thought it was important to bring up the simile of the sword, because that sort of like bounds the problem. How many people know about the simile of the sword? No one knows the Buddhist simile of the sword? Oh, wow. This is a very famous simile. But what I was really shocked was what it was referenced to. It's pretty graphic. The Buddha goes, bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teachings. Here in bhikkhus, you should thus train. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for the welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We will abide pervading with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. That is how you should train. Now, this is a really high standard. But he goes on to say, and this bounds the whole problem, goes back to speech. I always heard about this, but I never saw the whole sutta. He says, bhikkhus, if you keep this advice on the simile of the sword constantly in mind, do you see any course of speech, trivial or gross, that you could not endure? No, venerable sir. So when someone's like yelling and screaming at you, think of the sword and be glad it's not a sword. Another teacher says, you know, when someone's saying harsh words at you, they're just sounds coming into the ear, to think of it that way. But this does take a lot of practice, and I hope I'm showing you that to practice right speech and to practice precept of not lying is a whole practice in itself and should not be taken lightly. The last one is divisive speech, and the big one is gossiping, because many of us gossip, whether we like to admit it or not. And gossip is defined as speaking negative truths about a person, it's not telling lies about a person. Lies about a person is slander. But gossip is always negative. I mean, you don't usually hear, you know, you get together with a friend and go, hey, you hear Bill's a really great person? You really just want to hear juicy things. And the big thing about gossip, I mean, if you start gossiping, would you want people to gossip about you? And there's a whole issue of trust once you find out people have gossiping. How would we do this all the time? Now, one book I highly, highly recommend, it's written by a rabbi. It's called Words That Hurt, Words That Heal. And a lot of it's about gossip, but it's also a lot about right speech. Jewish tradition has written a lot about not gossiping and right speech. It's called Loshon Hara. Did I pronounce that correctly? In Judaism. To tell you how seriously, there's a in an Orthodox community, there was a community center, and there's a poster on the wall that says, don't gossip. And it shows a man being put into a meat grinder. Another thing, there was a famous rabbi in the 1800s called Chafetz Chaim, who wrote a book called Guard Your Tongue, which is like the definitive work on gossip. And a lot of Orthodox Jewish people will actually put a picture of him in front of their phone, so they get on the phone, they know not to gossip. One of the ways to help you not to gossip has friends who don't gossip and you carry it out, or if you have a partner who doesn't gossip and you can practice that. My grandmother's a great example. She'd never gossip. When people be gossiping about people, she says, can't you say something good about them? And that's also something we should think of. When we think of people's bad sides or people have hurt us, we try to think of their good sides also. The last topic in right speech is idle chatter. And Ajahn Fong, who's Ajahn Jeff's teacher, said, before you say anything, ask yourself whether it's necessary or not. If it is not, don't say it. This is the first step in training the mind. For if you can't have any control over your mouth, how can you expect to have any control over your mind? And someone once said, one teacher, I don't know who, but he says, you have two ears and one mouth. You should use it in those proportions. On the other side of right speech, we're always talking about things you shouldn't say, but there's also positive words, expressing appreciation, gratitude to people. And the last thing I want to talk about is emails and texting. We do a lot of our communications through that. And it's really a terrible way to communicate because most of our communication is nonverbal. I'm retired now, but when I worked, there was a program I was on. The program manager had a meeting at the beginning of the program and said, your number one mode of communication is to get up from your desk and go talk to the person. Number two is the phone. Number three is emails. And so with emailing, you have to be really extra careful because people can't read exactly your mean or your intent. I know a lot of trouble has been raised because of this and misunderstandings. So to sum up, you can see to practice right speech requires right view. You have to have, in right view, is the view to act skillfully. You have to have mindfulness. You have to remember to practice this, right effort. And also to have discernment to figure out how you can carry off right speech.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.